A small school system near Philadelphia is on the verge of going broke. The Chester Upland District has only enough money to pay its staff and remain open for a couple of weeks. As we hear from Elizabeth Fiedler of member station WHYY, parents, students, and teachers in the district are waiting to see what happens.
Last month, Chester Upland warned its teachers it was running out of money because of state budget cuts and rising payments to charter schools. Danielle Jennings, a Chester Upland parent, says she was shocked to learn teachers agreed to keep working temporarily without pay if the district couldn't meet payroll.
I think it's really admirable that teachers are willing to, they're that dedicated to educating that they will go, you know what, this is going to be hard on my family, but because I want these children to have a really good chance, I'm going to stay.
That hasn't happened yet. In January, the Chester Upland School Board filed a federal lawsuit against the state of Pennsylvania to force the state to provide more funding. A federal judge ordered the state to give the district a $3.2 million advance to keep schools open, while district officials and lawmakers search for a long-term solution to the district's financial problems. District officials said the money would allow it to meet payroll for a few weeks, but it needs about $20 million to make it through the end of the school year. Chester Upland's money problems run deep. It was already carrying about $10 million in debt from past years when it was hit with a 14% reduction in this year's budget. Paul Gottlieb is with the Pennsylvania State Education Association, the union that represents Chester Upland teachers.
The governor's cutting $866 million from the state education budget was the trigger that basically permitted or enabled the school district to fall flat on its face. Chester Upland gets approximately 70% of its revenue from the state.
Chester Upland has one of the highest student poverty rates in Pennsylvania. Because of its ongoing financial problems, the district was placed under state control from 1994 through 2010. And on top of that, in December, the Chester Upland Community Charter School, which teaches about 45% of the district's students, sued the Chester Upland District and the state for millions of dollars it said it was owed. At a recent town hall meeting, parents and community leaders packed the room, even though it was a weekday morning. Many spoke passionately about their love of the district and their frustration with the current predicament. State Senator Dominic Pileggi said he wants to know how the district ended up in such a financial hole.
I can tell you there's no appetite. There's no appetite to just simply keep sending money without accountability.
Pileggi listened to the crowd but didn't offer any immediate solutions.
I think we ought to just keep all options open until we decide what the best way for the children is. And whatever that becomes, that's what I'm going to be for. And I'm not going to prejudge it.
One concerned parent at the meeting, Chester High grad India Rodriguez, says she wants the district to rebound, but she's not staking her son's education on it. She just pulled him out of the district and put him in private school.
I just don't want to wait for the worst that can happen to happen, whereas one day they're like, you know, don't send your child to school. There's no school for him to go to.
State officials, including Governor Tom Corbett, say they are working to keep the district open, at least until the end of the school year. But they haven't said exactly how. A district spokesman says right now the district may not be able to pay teachers and support staff on February 15th. A federal judge has ordered the state and the district to try to resolve the situation by February 10th. For NPR News, I'm Elizabeth Fiedler in Philadelphia.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Women's boxing will be an Olympic sport for the first time in this summer's games. Among those competing to be part of the U.S. team in London, Tyrisha Douglas of Baltimore. When she was 16, Douglas was arrested for fighting. As she remembers it, her juvenile court judge recommended she take up boxing. Now she's 23, 112 pounds, and aiming for gold.
Boxing is my mother and my father. Boxing is my brother and my sister. Boxing make love to me. Boxing kiss me.
Keep that hand up again.
Honestly, boxing is the love of my life.
I have Teresa Douglas and Warren Jenkins.
Bout two, ring two.
Boxing, you can't be nice.
And mouth gear, you got your mouth gear on?
So I'm mean.
Ring two, red corner.
Let's go.
I know I'm a woman, but when the bell rings, I'm like a monster.
Get your money's worth.
Your three is money here. That's the money hand. There you go. Oh, beautiful, beautiful. Let's go. Okay.
All right. Oh, nice. Do it again.
When I was younger, I wanted to have big butt and big boobs. I wanted to be the average girl. People used to always say that women shouldn't have big arms, they shouldn't have broad shoulders. They'd be like, don't wear that t-shirt, you look too strong. Your outfit is cute, but you look like you about to break your high heel. And I'd be like, what? It's against the rules to have as many muscles as I have.
I'm Devon Douglas, Tyrisha's oldest brother.
This is my brother that I live with.
It's me, then it's her, and then it's Ronte, and then it's Antoine, then it's Desiree.
That is Dorshay the dog. Sit down. She's a blue pet.
We were on foster care, then we got broke up, and some of my friends told me, they were like, your sister box. I was like, my sister box? She was serious like long enough to box. They were like, well, the fight only lasted about a minute.
No.
They said she felt sorry for the girl. Like, is she really hurt?
Go over there. Listen, if I beat you up.
Hello.
How you doing, baby? Here at the bottom. Shut the door, Antoine.
I was born into a rough family.
I'm Annette Douglas, Tyrisha Douglas' mom.
Both of my parents was on drugs.
I just was never there. Doing drugs, you don't stay home. You just go and flow wherever it is.
What do I remember?
I had to protect my brothers. I'm like, mom is doing good. She working, not telling them that our mom is a crackhead.
Best sister in the world, you ask me.
Aww. I was out of control, which means if you say anything to me, I will break your face. And that was the end of that. The first memory that I have of ever seeing boxing was when we was living with my cousin Patrick Washington.
Me and my brother were in the house one day. He tells us, go get in the car. And y'all want to box?
Marcy used to always take me shopping and go get my hair done while y'all was at the gym, and I used to be mad. When I seen it, I was like, oh my gosh, that is so amazing. You get to beat up people for free. So I asked him about it maybe one time when I was young, and he was like, no. Like, his no was like, no. Like, you ain't about to do that. You're a girl. If it wasn't for me getting in trouble again, no will still have been his answer to this day.
And today we're here. And she's in the running to make history and be on the Olympic team.
One, two, three.
USA!
We're here in Oxnard, California.
We were here to get the girls prepared for international competition. Oh, I am Gloria Pete, one of the coaches for USA Boxing.
We train every 5 minutes, no sleep, no rest. We slipping punches while we on the toilet.
We're at a round robin tournament meeting women from Poland, Russia, Mexico, and from Germany. See, she pissing me off.
Hold on, seriously, you guys are elite athletes. Act like that. You're not just representing yourselves anymore, you're representing your country.
Some countries have camps for women. Some train year round, three times a day. This competition is extremely important because it gives the girl something to gauge their performance by. Everything is in preparation for 2012 Olympics.
I'm very excited about today because the boxing starts today.
It's cool to see like girls fight.
Team USA all the way, baby.
They're awesome and powerful.
Blue corner boxers, please glove up.
I'm Christy Hallberg. I've been coaching on the international level since 1999.
My mouthpiece, Robonji.
I'm the red corner representing Team USA, Tyrisha Douglas.
When I get in the ring, what am I telling myself?
In the blue
stay
corner,
calm.
Representing Team Germany. Azizi.
Stay calm.
All right, Tyrisha, go do your thing, babe. Be you, all right? Be you.
This is my ticket.
Fast hands. Yeah, left hand. Good, get it, do it again.
Boxing is not easy. If you are strong enough to stand up against all the odds that you face, there is something within you that is special.
All right, good round.
Take my mouthpiece out.
She doesn't like your power. Can you see that?
If you can get hit and hit a person back, you have to have heart. You might get hurt. That's hot to me.
Exhale all the air out of your lungs. You're giving away some points because your hands are down and she's throwing a straight right at you, okay? So circle to your right and hit her with the hook on the way, all right? You can win this. You're only down two. Circle right with the hook. Circle right. She's just not going to circle to the right, Fausto. She's not going to do it. Left hand. Double it up.
Round of applause, please, for bout number 10. Our winner, representing Team Germany, Azizi Nemani.
All right.
Didn't get the fight. 17-15, that was the score. I still get to compete every day, so. On to the next.
How would you like to build on this for tomorrow?
Do angles and circles and just keep my head on my shoulder and USA all the way.
All the way, baby.
What she have to really work on is herself. That's what I'm waiting on.
Let's go.
Calvin Ford is my coach, who's also like a father to me.
Her first national champion medal, I have it. She gave it to me, you know.
He really treats me like a daughter. I call him all hours of the night. He answers the phone. I get mad when he don't answer the phone. So he's really like a father to me.
10 back down to 2.
Like, she's drained today.
I'm tired.
She looking flat. She looking real flat. Ain't she?
Sometimes I doubt my dreams.
She got a lot on her mind.
And I feel so low.
Six punches that we just missed in that round because you wasn't feeling good. That's your fault. Shucks, whatever's on your mind, it can't be on your mind now. You got to fight through that.
I'm not only doing this for me. I'm doing this for the world. Because if I can do it, the next individual can do it. Just to see someone get that far in life, that's all I want to show, is that you can overcome anything and be anything you want in life. And I am going to be that woman. I am.
That's it. She's done. Yeah, she's done.
I go home to my bed. It's just me. My heart. Dreaming about being an Olympic gold medalist. And if that gold medalist dream don't happen, I'm still going to give and do and strive for what I want. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Tyrisha Douglas will compete in the first women's Olympic boxing trials later this month. Our story was produced for member station WNYC by Marianne McCune with Sue J. Johnson. You can see photographs of Tyrisha Douglas in action at npr.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The social scientist Charles Murray writes this in his new book. Our nation is coming apart at the seams, not ethnic seams, but the seams of class. Murray's book is in fact called Coming Apart, The State of White America, 1960 to 2010. Over the past half century, he argues, white Americans have come to include a new upper class, defined more than ever before by education, and a new lower class, characterized by the lack of it. And the new lower class is also less industrious, less likely to marry and raise children in a two-family household, and less connected to the rest of society. By focusing on whites, Murray tries to correct the assumption that these are markers of the American racial divide. Charles Murray is a libertarian, and his previous books include Losing Ground and The Bell Curve, the controversial book about IQ as a determinant of many socioeconomic outcomes. And he joins us today. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
To the program. First, since we Americans love to consider ourselves middle class, whether we're factory workers or neurosurgeons, how big do you figure the new upper class is and how big is the new lower class?
Well, if you talk about the upper middle class, which is a subset of the new upper class, you're talking about 20% of the white adult population. And the white working class these days represents about 30% of the white adult population.
And they are separated both geographically and also culturally.
Both of those. There has developed over the last 50 years distinctive tastes and preferences among people who share high levels of education and also are affluent. This involves everything from the way they raise their children to the foods they eat, the way they take care of their bodies, the cars they drive, you name it. In addition to that, there has been an increasing spatial separation, so that you have zip codes that have levels of affluence and education that are so much higher than the rest of the population that they constitute a different kind of world. And these in terms form clusters.
One surprise that emerges from your data is that the new upper class, people who might often be ridiculed as latte liberals, contemptuous of traditional values, are in fact the people who are getting and staying married more. They're the people who continue to go to church or synagogue more. They work more hours. They are exemplars of traditional American values.
It's strange because we think of the upper middle class, for example, as being secular, that they've fallen away from religion. Well, it turns out that the upper middle class goes to church more often and feels a much stronger affiliation with their religion than the white working class.
You feel this is a dangerous situation, that the white upper middle class, the educated middle class, is so separate from the bottom percent.
I think it's potentially very dangerous because, let's face it, the people who run the country have enormous influence over the culture and the politics and the economics of the country. And increasingly, they haven't a clue about how most of America lives. They have never experienced it. They don't watch the same movies. They don't watch the same television shows. And when that happens, you get some policies that are pretty far out of whack.
I guess the question that I had in reading Coming Apart is how different this is, how different today is from the past. And it seems to me that by contrasting today, which I think you describe pretty well, with 1960, or in the preface actually 1963, seems to me you've chosen not the way we used to be, but the way the country was at a high point of leveling, unifying experiences. My father and all the other fathers had been in the Second World War. They'd experienced the Depression at one age or another. They'd come through the GI Bill. Nobody seemed to object to hugely high tax rates. It was a time which I would think was remarkably unified, and to my reading provides perhaps a false baseline for how much worse things are today as previously in our history.
You could actually make an argument that even earlier in the century there was even greater mixture of the different classes, and a lot of that was done by lodges. You know, the Elks and the Moose and you name it. There were lots and lots of these, which took people in from all social classes, and people were proud of that. Also, you have the 1800s, and Alexis de Tocqueville saying, you know, the funny thing about America is that the more opulent members of the society take great care to talk to the members of the lower classes every day and keep in close touch with them.
I was thinking of say, 1923, if that had been a baseline for where we are today, as opposed to 1963, huge immigrant nativist differences, communities that were utterly apart, linguistically apart from one another, Catholics and Protestants divided on a basic thing like prohibition, urban tenement living, as opposed to what was still a very large population of small farmers in the country. I'd have thought we'd say, well, back then we were far more divided.
There's a way in which that was different in an important respect, which is almost all the people who were successful in 1923 had started out in the working class family or a middle class family. Very few of them were second or third generation affluent. And so when you got, for example, Eisenhower's cabinet in 1952, it was called Nine Millionaires and a Plumber. In the popular press. And they were nine millionaires and a plumber. But all those nine millionaires, I think with one exception, had grown up, you know, as farmers' sons or small merchants' sons and so forth.
But, you know, I took note of what you wrote about Eisenhower's cabinet. You said all but two had not been born into affluent families. So today, not including the small business administrator who was given a new chair last week, there are 15 cabinet secretaries. By another measure, there are four women, two Asians, one black, two Latinos. One could say this is a group, by today's measure, who are immeasurably more diverse than Eisenhower's cabinet secretaries.
Oh, it's definitely more
gender and ethnically
diverse, but not socioeconomically.
What should the attitude, as you see it, of the new upper class be toward the new lower class? I understand you better. Should it be, I have some lessons to teach you? What's the stance between one and the other?
The new upper class should drop its non-judgmentalism. I want the new upper class to start preaching what it practices. They are getting married and staying married in large numbers. They work like crazy, long hours. They even do better going to church than lots of the rest of America. Why not just say these are not just choices we have made for ourselves? These are rich, rewarding ways of living.
I just want to ask you before you go about the decision to write about white America. It would be akin, one could say, to saying I'm going to write about Britain, but I'm not going to talk about the class system at all. Was this entirely a matter of trying to pre-butt people who would say, oh, he's talking about blacks? Or were you in fact saying, after the bell curve, maybe I'd better not write about blacks. People will receive what I write so unfavorably. I'll just talk about white people.
I wanted to limit it to whites to concentrate the minds of my readers. When we talk about a lot of the social problems that are in the book, the reflexive response is, oh, well, you know, those problems are really a lot worse in the black community or in the Latino community than in the white community. And this way, I can say throughout the book, just put that all out of your minds. Yeah. These are problems in the white community. However, in the penultimate chapter of the book, I say, suppose we put everybody in the mix. What do these trend lines look like?
You say it's the same thing.
Guess what, folks? It looks just the same.
Well, Charles Murray, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Charles Murray is the author of Coming Apart, The State of White America, 1960 to 2010.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
For millions of people in the developing world, one thing stands between them and school or a job, and that is a good pair of glasses. Eye care is often a luxury in areas where health services are scarce. So researchers and entrepreneurs are looking for breakthrough technologies to bring down the cost of glasses and eye exams. NPR's Larry Abramson reports that one idea starts with a smartphone.
While glasses may be hard to come by in some places, smartphones are becoming more and more common. So a group of researchers is trying to turn those phones into eye exam machines. David Shaffrin is with iNetra, an MIT spinoff company, developing a connection between eyes and cell phones.
And our goal really is to empower millions and millions around the world by bringing eye care to people's homes in a way that was never possible before.
iNetra has developed a $2 scope that healthcare workers can clip onto a smartphone. The patient stares through the eyepiece and follows colored lines that appear on the screen. Software installed on the phone translates your responses into a measurement of your refractive error. That's what an optometrist needs to make you a pair of glasses. Shaffrin says it's just a question of leveraging the power of the smartphone.
Well, the phone is actually doing everything. It's projecting the images, and it's also doing the calculations. That's where all the smarts are.
iNetra is testing these devices in clinics all over the world. The hope is that they will be accurate enough to change optometry, both in developing countries and maybe even in more affluent areas. But there is skepticism. The classic eye exam starts with an automated reading by an expensive machine, which iNetra aims to replace. Next, your doctor follows up with a series of questions. Which lens helps you see better, number one or number two? Kuldev Singh, a professor at Stanford University, says for the consumer to be happy, that second subjective test is crucial.
Science helps, but I don't think there's a substitute for actually checking to see if the patient is satisfied with the refraction that any automated device will find.
iNetra says relying on the automated exam can be just as accurate, and it makes the process cheaper and more accessible. But once you get your prescription, you still have to get glasses made. iNetra's developers envision a network of providers that would lead from prescription to eyewear. But in some places, patients are already building their own glasses. The Center for Vision in the Developing World is collaborating with Dow Corning on cheap glasses with lenses made of liquid silicon. Dow's James Stevenson says initially the glasses are equipped with a little pump that can adjust the shape of this liquid lens.
And the user basically looks through the glasses, they cover up one eye, and they literally turn the pump until the object comes into very clear vision.
The biggest downside with these glasses, initially called ad specs, is that they're pretty clunky looking. The developers are working on a sleeker, more stylish version. These are promising technologies, but those who work in the developing world caution that many patients don't know that they could see better, so they don't ask for help. And Stanford's Kuldev Singh says once you get a patient to come to a clinic, it's important to go beyond glasses.
Certainly, it's not a substitute for a complete exam that checks the eyes for potentially blinding diseases like glaucoma and macular degeneration.
At the same time, a little health care is better than none at all, especially when the ability to see well can mean so much to a child trying to see a blackboard in school. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, providing automatic online backup to protect photos, music, and other computer files from loss. Details at carbonite.com.
This is NPR News.
And we stay on the topic of football for this next story, but instead of blockbuster ads and multi-million dollar stadiums, we're looking at the less glamorous side of the game and perhaps one just as more compelling. Jamie King played football in high school and for a semi-pro league for 3 years, but his NFL dreams never exactly took off. He got his second chance when he was asked to coach a little-known team in a little-known league, the Fredericksburg Generals in Virginia. King recruited among men like himself, men with unfulfilled athletic dreams who had a lot to prove. But King even got a former NFL MVP to join the effort. And the story of how Jamie King pulled them together and this team in the mid-90s and turned them into champions is the cover story in this week's Washington Post magazine. It's called The General's Last Charge, and Jamie King joins me now in our Washington studios. Welcome to the program, Jamie King.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's an honor to be here, and I appreciate you guys having us on, and it's exciting to talk about what happened so many years ago, and it's still relevant. People still enjoy the story, so...
It is a really good story, and we'll get to it in just a second. But I do want to say, Jamie, for people not familiar with the team, who are the Fredericksburg Generals? And tell us even about this league. Perhaps some people don't even know about it.
Well, the league is called the Mason-Dixon League out of is based actually in Richmond. But the entire league is called the American Football Association with over 500 teams in the nation. And we were based in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and Fredericksburg Generals formed in 1994, and we had an incredible run shortly thereafter.
And let's just sidestep for a moment. This piece begins with you as a child watching your beloved Redskins and a father who was abusive, and he told you you weren't going to amount to anything. How did football help you get through this?
Well, I think football is a common denominator for a lot of things in life, especially you know believing in yourself and able to dig through some tough times and just continue to battle. You're going to have ups and downs and everything in sports, and fortunately, I was able to kind of fortify myself within the sports world and kind of give myself something to believe in, and this team definitely helped me with that.
And a lot of your players were men who, like yourself, needed another chance. But one of the people that you got on was your favorite player, the place kicker Mark Moseley. Eventually, you got him to sign up with your team, and he was 47. Tell me how that happened.
Well, like I say, it was pretty remarkable. Mark, I'd known him, actually watched him as a young guy, and admired him as just a fan, like most Redskin fans, and then was able to meet him, and he came to a couple of football camps, got to know him a little bit, and then I invited him down to help us with the team, and he was kicking pretty good, and I said, hey, we need help, and would you consider it? And it took quite a bit of prodding, but he came on, and it was just an amazing thing at 47 years of age to work with guys half his age in some cases and to provide the leadership that he did and all of the things that he provided for us outside of football. It was just an amazing thing, and came at a great time in his life, and was very big for us in the community.
Well, he needed you as much as you needed him.
I didn't know. I knew that he'd been going through some tough personal things, and a lot of people didn't. He confided some things in me, and I know he'd been having some tough things going his life, and this team really helped him get a resurgence in his life and have a bright future, and we were excited about that, and it all worked out with him in the lineup. We were 20-0. We never lost a game.
It makes me think of a play. You had two championship seasons.
Yes, ma'am. 95 and 96.
And after that, why did you all disband?
Well, you know, once you've climbed the mountaintop and you've done everything, the view is very as beautiful as it gets. And so many of those guys, I think, had fulfilled everything they wanted to and basically said, hey, we're going to go out on top. And they walked away from it. But it was an incredible group of guys and an incredible accomplishment that we achieved.
Jamie King, what are you doing today? What do you think is the lesson? This all happened more than a decade ago, but there's something kind of timeless about it. What's everyone doing now?
Well, as far as lessons, I mean, for me personally, you know, there's a lot of kids out there that have dealt with abuse, whether it be physical and verbal and so forth. And one thing I hope from our story, that my story in particular, that they learn is, you know, never give up on yourself, never give up on your future, that there is going to be a brighter day if you believe in yourself. And one thing I like to tell parents out there is, you know, for step parents, yeah, I admire the ones that do it the right way. And it's not an easy thing to take families on that in some cases you never knew about. And for parents that do it the right way, the regular parents, I admire them more than anything, to see parents and the sacrifices they make. Sometimes, as I tell kids all the time, if you've got two great parents or one great parent in your life, really be proud of that and make sure you tell them.
Jamie King is the former coach of the Mason-Dixon League team, the Fredericksburg Generals. He's now the owner of the King Management Group, a sports management company. And thank you so much for joining us in our studio.
Thank you so much for having me.